Jones.
From Washington, this is VOA News. CIA torture report to be released today. Sierra Leone, new number one in Ebola cases. I'm Ray Kugel reporting from Washington. The U.S. Senate plans to release a long-awaited report today detailing the CIA's interrogation methods since the September 11, 2001 attacks. It will be the first public documentation of the CIA's alleged use of torture and al-Qaeda suspects during the so-called War on Terror. Here is White House spokesman Josh Earnest.
The president believes that on principle, it's important to release that report so that people around the world and people here at home understand exactly what transpired. There are obviously going to be some limits about what can be said given the classified nature of the program. But because of the scrupulous work of the committee and the administration and the intelligence community in particular, we've declassified as much of that report as we can.
The 6,000-page report is said to detail such extreme interrogation techniques as sleep deprivation and waterboarding, which simulates drowning. The World Health Organization says new cases of Ebola continue to climb in West Africa, saying Sierra Leone has overtaken Liberia as the country with the highest number of cases. Infection rates for Ebola are decreasing in Liberia, but still has more Ebola deaths than any other country. The WHO death toll for Ebola, 6,300. The commander of the U.S.-led coalition fighting the Islamic State says coalition partners have promised to put 1,500 military advisors on the ground in Iraq. Army Lieutenant General James Terry says they would join the U.S. forces already there training the Iraqi army. Speaking in Kuwait City Monday, General Terry said Islamic State militants are now on the defensive and trying to hold on to the parts of Iraq they control but still can carry out attacks. This is VOA News. There's been another night of protests and die-ins in cities across the United States, protesting grand jury decisions not to indict white policemen in the deaths of unarmed black men. Marches are being held in New York, Washington, Philadelphia, and Berkeley, California. The United Nations is appealing for $16.4 billion to provide humanitarian assistance next year to more than 57 million people in 22 countries mired in conflict and brutality. Lisa Schlein has details.
The United Nations says every year humanitarian needs grow bigger and the available resources to meet those needs grow smaller. It estimates about 78 million people worldwide need assistance. But because of limited funds, the United Nations has pared down the number of people it can help to 57.5 million of the most vulnerable. UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs Valerie Amos says four countries, Syria, South Sudan, Iraq, and Central African Republic, will remain the top priorities next year. Lisa Schlein, Geneva.
The Philippine capital, Manila, is bracing for a weakening typhoon Hagupit, which caused widespread destruction and killed at least 23 people after coming ashore on the eastern island of Samar. It's been downgraded to a tropical storm, but emergency officials are on high alert for flooding and storm surges in Manila. Russia says it is committed to holding talks this week on ending the violence in eastern Ukraine. President Vladimir Putin's foreign policy advisor says Russia is ready for another meeting of the so-called contact group in eastern Ukraine this week. Britain's Prince William visited Washington for the first time Monday and called for a crackdown on the illegal trade in world wildlife. Prince William met with President Obama at the White House, where they talked about the criminality involved in the wildlife trade. The prince later delivered a speech on the issue at a World Bank conference.
In my view, one of the most insidious forms of corruption and criminality in the world today is the illegal wildlife trade. Here, criminal gangs turn vast profits from the illegal killing or capture of wildlife. Armed groups and terrorists swap poached ivory for guns, and middlemen oil the wheels of the trade in return for reward.
While Prince William was in Washington, Kate, pregnant with a couple second child, toured a New York Child Development Center with the wife of New York Mayor Bill de Blasio. Canada closed its embassy in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, because of security concerns. There's been no detailed explanation for the embassy closing, but a note on its website said consular services may be limited due to unsettled security conditions. Britain's embassy in Cairo remained shut Monday for a second day with no details about a specific threat. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. An opposition leader says he is an alternative to political confusion and a better economy in Zambia.
Our main reason for seeking public office is to turn around the economy. We will focus on creating and improving the business and investment operating environment.
Hakainde Hichilema is the leader of Zambia's opposition United Party for National Development. Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila reshuffles his cabinet to create a national cohesion government. Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF Party Congress ends with more purge of loyalists of deposed Vice President Joyce Mujuru. And the World Health Organization says malaria deaths have dropped to their lowest since 2000.
Mortality in children under five, the age group which concentrates the biggest malaria problem in terms of severe disease and death, has reduced by a staggering 58%.
Pedro Alonso is the WHO Malaria Program Director. Timbuktu residents get electricity that many in the rest of Mali cannot afford. And tomorrow is United Nations Human Rights Day, as 2014 is being highlighted as a year of horrific rights violations. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's Sports and Our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The leader of Zambia's opposition, United Party for National Development, says of the country's three main political parties, his is the only stable one. As a result, Hakainde Hichilema says the people of Zambia are looking up to him to lead the country. Zambians go to the polls next month in a special election to choose a successor to President Michael Sata, who died in October this year. Sata's ruling Patriotic Front Party has been embroiled in inter-party squabbles over who should be the presidential candidate. The opposition movement for multi-party democracy has also chosen two presidential candidates. Hichilema says Zambians are using his party as a platform for unity and development. He says he is not surprised by the factionalism within the ruling Patriotic Front Party.
I'm not surprised, because the ruling party has always exhibited the traits of confusion and lack of order. In fact, they are the ones that have been perpetrating the breakdown in the rule of law. All of that has been happening even before the late president passed on. Now that he's passed on, I'm not surprised about the confusion in there. This is how basically the fabric of that party is structured. As for the MMD, it's really unfortunate, but I think those are their issues, those are their troubles. For us as UPND, it's the only stable party in the country. I'm talking of the three large parties. This is the only stable party in the country, and that's why the people of Zambia have made a decision to give UPND an opportunity to run this country, to turn around the economy of this country.
Were you planning on joining with any of these parties, or do you see this political confusion as an opportunity for you to step forward now for the Zambian people?
We have already stepped forward. We are basically already providing leadership from the opposition. We are running the country already from the opposition. I think what is now expected is to formalize that through an election, so that the country can be run by us directly. And one of our key objectives is to reunite the country, which has been divided, because we need a united country as a platform for an accelerated economic and social development. By the way, in case you are not aware, over 20 MMD MPs have already endorsed my candidate as president. We are inviting a lot more Zambians, because the UPND should be used as a platform of unity to give Zambia an opportunity for development.
What do you make of the Zambian economy right now, and what would you do if you were elected president?
The Zambian economy is challenged today. I mean, if you look at the basic measures of economic performance, they are all reasonably negative, so to say. Our main reason for seeking public office is to turn around the economy, to begin to move Zambia, which is endowed with substantial resources, yet its people are poor. And the reason is that there's bad leadership. And how are we going to do that? We will focus on creating and improving the business and investment operating environment. Make it attractive, credible, predictable, consistent. And once we do that, we will see basically the investments that are in Zambia. They will choose to stay. They will also do more than staying. They will reinvest, and we expect more investments to come into the country.
Hakainde Hichilema is the leader of Zambia's opposition United Party for National Development. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. President Joseph Kabila of the Democratic Republic of Congo has carried out a cabinet reshuffle, bringing into the government some members of the opposition. The finance, defense, and interior ministers, as well as three deputy prime ministers, have all been replaced. The changes come as insecurity continues in the eastern part of the country. Information Minister Lambert Mende says the new government fulfills President Kabila's promise made more than a year ago to form a government of national cohesion.
The president announced 1 year ago when we went on what we call the national consultation that he was trying to reshuffle the executive so as to bring in the most political wings because of building national cohesion. It took a long time. He was very much criticized for it. But now, 1 year later, it seems that he succeeded in bringing in some opposition leaders with which now we are in a national and a cohesive government.
Does national cohesion mean a government of national unity so that to bring about peace in the country?
Yes. The idea is to help our country to really succeed in all the endeavors we are doing to bring peace and security, mostly at the eastern part of our country that is being destabilized for maybe 20 years now.
Do you think this will help to quell the conflict in the east?
The main reason of this government is to build in our country unity, to stop these quarrels in order that all of us, we really focus on what we should do to stop these mass killings in the eastern part of country, what we should do to enhance the strength of our army and the security forces, what we should do to really change from our country all these foreigners who are bringing death to our people there.
Of course, Mr. Minister, there's always this skepticism that some people in the opposition think that the president made these changes as he's been criticized, whether he's going to seek a third term. Is this reshuffle a way to quell that criticism?
This is totally irrelevant, my dear. You are talking of an electoral process that is being waited for 2 years to come. We are in 2014, my dear brother. And this election we are talking of is scheduled for the end of 2016. Where have you seen an electoral campaign that could take 2 years? This is irrelevant.
Lambert Mende is Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. In Zimbabwe, the ruling ZANU-PF purge targeting suspected loyalists of the under-fire Vice President Joyce Mujuru continued on Monday with two cabinet ministers and five others being dumped from the Central Committee just 2 days after the ruling party's Congress. Thomas Choripasi has details from Harare.
Officially closing the 6th ZANU-PF National Congress on Saturday, President Robert Mugabe directed his party activists from Mashonaland and East Province to convene an urgent meeting to re-elect their representatives to the Central Committee, saying he had taken this decision following complaints from party members in that province. Some Congress delegates reportedly complained that some members loyal to Mrs. Mujuru had been elected to the powerful Central Committee. Mr. Mugabe directed the provincial structure to expedite this process so that he could have time to assess the new members before appointing members of the Presidium and the Politburo.
We will ensure you sit down, Nevan. We are prepared that you redo the exercise.
Following Mr. Mugabe's directive, ZANU-PF's Provincial Coordinating Committee for Mashonaland and East Province met in Marondera today and reportedly decided to recall Defense Minister Sidney Sekera Mai and Health Minister David Parrenyatwa from the Central Committee. Political analyst Blessing Vava says the recalling of Sekera Mai is a well-calculated move by those aligned to the ZANU-PF faction, led by Justice Minister Emmerson Mnangagwa, to block Sekera Mai, long believed to be a candidate in the race to succeed Mr. Mugabe, from being appointed into the ZANU-PF presidium.
Well, the sacking of Sekera Mai is not surprising. This was something that was coming, basically on the fact that he was linked to a camp that is believed or that is alleged to be have been plotting against the ouster of President Mugabe. And what it means now is that all the comrades who were in the Mujuru camp have lost their positions, which makes it very clear that the front runners to succeed President Robert Mugabe are those now belonging to the Mnangagwa faction.
Mr. Mugabe told delegates at the just concluded ZANU-PF Congress that he would be announcing the presidium and members of the Politburo this week after Congress ratified the ruling party's constitution to allow him to make the appointments. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 9th, and please send your comments and opinions to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. The World Health Organization says there has been a dramatic decrease in the number of malaria deaths since 2000, and that the number of cases is also steadily going down. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Sub-Saharan Africa bears the brunt of malaria, with 90% of global deaths occurring there. But this year's World Malaria Report says Africa's population has grown by 43% since 2000, with fewer people getting infected. WHO Global Malaria Program Director Pedro Alonso says the number of people infected fell from 173 million in 2000 to 128 million in 2013. He says that is particularly good news for children, who are the biggest victims of this fatal but preventable disease.
Mortality in children under five, the age group which concentrates the biggest malaria problem in terms of severe disease and death, has reduced by a staggering 58%. And if we try to quantify the number of lives saved since 2000 up to 2014, we estimate that over 4 million deaths have been averted.
The World Health Organization says the results are due to greater access to malaria control interventions. Dr. Alonso says greater access to rapid diagnostic tests and effective treatment also has significantly improved. He says these are not complex, expensive interventions, and health systems can build on these measures.
We also need to sustain a strong pipeline of research and development and innovation to develop new tools. We face significant challenges with the emergence and spread of artemisinin resistance, particularly in Southeast Asia. We need to tackle that problem, and we can tackle it in both ways, by developing new drugs that could potentially take over from ACTs if and when they fail and that resistance spreads.
Another sign of progress is the increasing number of countries moving toward malaria elimination. But the report says indoor residual spraying has decreased in recent years, and insecticide resistance has been reported in 49 countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
One of the first things Mali's new government did after the end of the Islamist occupation of the north was to restore the power grid and introduce a voucher payment system for residents of Timbuktu. It has become a hardship, sometimes having to choose between electricity or food on the table. Katerina Hoyer reports from Timbuktu.
On the northwestern edge of Timbuktu, where the city gives way to the endless Sahara, a young man, a Tuareg, sits in front of a mud house. He's playing an ngoni, a string instrument common in West Africa. As the Islamist militias gained ground in 2012, he fled to the desert like many Arabs and Tuaregs. Later he got a ride to Mauritania's capital, Nouakchott, on the Atlantic coast, where he went looking for work. He only returned last year, after French troops pushed the Islamists out of major towns in northern Mali in January 2013. Many have since returned to Timbuktu, only to find their shops and homes were vandalized and looted, and to find they're not so welcomed. Traditionally, nomadic Arabs and Tuaregs make up about 13% of Mali's 15.9 million people, the majority of whom are black. Following the liberation, light-skinned Tuaregs and Arabs were viewed as sympathetic to the Islamist occupation. Some had in fact been given senior positions within the armed groups, but many were just traders who depended on goodwill from the militants in order to transport their goods along roads and sell them at markets controlled by the Islamists. Some who stayed here paid with their lives. Human rights groups say dozens of people were killed by the military during and after the military intervention in early 2013. Others disappeared. The most well-known case is that of a 70-year-old man known as Vieux Ali, or Old Ali. He was last seen on the morning of February 14th, when several witnesses says he was arrested by soldiers, shoved into the back of a truck, and put under a blanket. When Mohammed Urali learned about the disappearance of his relative through family members, he returned immediately to Timbuktu to find out what happened to his uncle. Every time I asked, I was told the investigation was underway. No one could tell me what happened to my uncle or the other people who disappeared, Mohammed Urali says. Eventually, the old man's body was found in the desert outside of Timbuktu. Other family members and friends remain missing, says Mohammed Urali. Almost 2 years after the French-led intervention to free the northern two-thirds of Mali, the people of Timbuktu still reel from the violence forced upon them by the armed rebels who occupy the city. There is fear of the jihadists, who may not be in control now, but are here. And the fear of arbitrary arrests by the Malian military remains. In town, peacekeepers patrol the streets. Arab and Tuareg residents say the presence of international soldiers does make them feel safer than in the desert. Katrina Höje for VOA News in Timbuktu.
Tomorrow, Wednesday, is United Nations Human Rights Day. Many observers describe 2014 as a horrific year for human rights violations. War is the major source of abuses around the world, and in the past 12 months, major conflicts have intensified. Henry Richwell reports for VOA from London.
The Syrian civil war is approaching its fourth year. Hundreds of thousands have been killed and millions forced from their homes. In the past 12 months, the conflict has splintered and spread to neighboring Iraq, with government forces, moderate opposition fighters, Islamist militants, and Kurdish fighters all battling for territory. The international community must take some responsibility, says Steve Crawshaw, senior advisor at Amnesty International.
The failures to address the Syrian conflict better and earlier and to really speak out loudly and put the kind of pressures that were needed for human rights to be better observed.
The sound of a barrel bomb exploding over a suburb of Aleppo earlier this month. The crude weapon, a barrel packed with explosives dropped from a helicopter, has been used widely by Syrian government forces, killing thousands of civilians. Syria's key ally, Russia, should speak out against their use, says Director of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth.
They allow ISIS to say that at least it is standing up to the Russian-backed government in Damascus that is trying to commit mass murder among civilians in opposition-held areas.
Moscow, meanwhile, is fueling conflict in the east of Ukraine by providing military support to separatists. Close to 4,500 people have been killed, and there are numerous cases of abduction and torture. On a recent visit to Moscow, Kenneth Roth of Human Rights Watch said the situation could deteriorate.
I think it is political insecurity that lies behind all of this, and I fear that this is only going to intensify as Russia now encounters some real economic problems as a consequence of Putin's adventurism in Ukraine.
Russia's increasing isolation has led to the worst crackdown on dissent within Russia since Soviet times, according to Roth. China is accused of rolling back recent progress on human rights with its ongoing crackdown on pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. The spread of Islamist militant groups in Africa is driving human rights violations on a vast scale. killings and suicide attacks by Boko Haram in Nigeria are intensifying, while Nigerian government forces are accused of beheadings and torture. In Egypt, campaigners say the hopes of the Arab Spring protesters are all but extinguished. Overall, though, Human Rights Day 2014 will likely be seen as a reminder of the vast scale of abuses in many parts of the world. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Hosts Equatorial Guinea play Chad in Bata as Republic of Congo face Cameroon in Malabo in semi-final action at the Central Africa Economic and Monetary Community CEMAC Cup today, Tuesday. Defending champions Gabon and the Central African Republic, who were finalists last year, have been eliminated at the end of the six-nation group stage contest. Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon and the Republic of Congo are using the annual two-week event to test their finest home-based players who could make their respective teams for the Orange Africa Cup of Nations, which kicks off in Equatorial Guinea next month. Meanwhile, Tanzania hosts Rwanda in a friendly international match in Dar es Salaam today, Tuesday. The match is part of Tanzania's Independence Day celebrations. Turning to volleyball, in an all-Ugandan final, Nicolas De Jonghera and Emmanuel Kato dismissed Dixon Otim and Ambrose Okello in the men's final at the Castle International Beach Volleyball Tournament in Entebbe, Uganda on Sunday. Rwanda's Olivier Ntangengwa and Vincent Ruhumuriza clinched the bronze medal. Ugandans also dominated the women's event, where Peace Businje and Christine Alupo beat Hafsa Nakalema and Mercy Tabitha in the finals. Moving on to athletics, 41-year-old Kenneth Mungara led David Taras and Charles Kanyao in a 1-2-3 Kenyan triumph at the Standard Chartered Marathon in Singapore on Sunday. Ethiopian Waganesh Amare carried the day in the women's race. She was followed across the finish line by Kenyans Elizabeth Chemweno and Pauline Wangui. Meanwhile, Solomon Keter and Thomas Martim made it a 1-2 Kenyan win in the men's 10 kilometers, while Ethiopian legend Haile Gebrselassie claimed the bronze medal. In the Netherlands, Eritrean Miskel Tewelde prevailed at the Monterland 15-kilometer run in Herenden on Sunday. Kenyan Norbert Kigen and Geoffrey Koech placed second and third, while Ethiopian Askale Merachi won the women's race. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, December 9th.
Good morning. This is William Koklo, and I speak to you from Monrovia, Liberia. Mr. Robert Sully's statement yesterday on this very program indicating that he was going to file in his petition on Monday, November 8, 2014, contradicts the Minister of Information of the Republic of Liberia, Mr. Louis Brown, earlier comments that the court of Liberia has placed a stay order on Executive Order 65 based on a complaint filed by Mr. Sirleaf. I wonder, Mr. Louis Brown has now become the official spokesperson of Mr. Sirleaf's campaign team. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The World Health Organization says new cases of Ebola continue to rise in West Africa, and it says Sierra Leone has overtaken Liberia as the country with the highest number of cases. That's it for this Tuesday, December 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ullman, I am James Barton, Washington, saying have a nice day, Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.